Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I am delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Tim Shorrock, who blogs at timshorrock.com. That's T-I-M-S-H-O-R-R-O-C-K.com, and writes for The Nation magazine. He was in Korea recently during the marking of the 60th anniversary of the armistice, and we are going to talk about the past 60 years in North and South Korea. Tim Shorrock, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much.
You lived in South Korea as a child in the 60s. You've been an observer of Korea over the decades, and your view, as mine, seems to be that the U.S. media and perhaps even the U.S. president have just about everything wrong about the war and what's happened since. Let's start with this. President Barack Obama has declared the Korean War a victory. What do you make of that?
Well, actually, I was appalled to hear him say that. This is a kind of right-wing myth that began to be pushed about in the early 1990s, sort of at the same time at the Berlin Wall fell and the end of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. And some right-wing scholars started promoting the Korean War as a great victory for the United States when historically it had always been seen, and in reality, it was a stalemate. There was a period of time before 1950 when South Korea was convulsed with rebellion from labor unions and students against the right-wing dictatorship that was in charge after the U.S. accepted the surrender of Japan in the South. And this culminated in a counterinsurgency, a major counterinsurgency in 1946 and 47. Terrible losses, a terrible war, very few Americans know about it. And then, of course, in 1950, North Korea sent its forces across the border in their mind to liberate the South from U.S. Rule. And then there was that war went on for 3 years because the United States, under General MacArthur, came in and sent U.S. forces to intervene at the famous Incheon port, where they sent in all these U.S. troops and cut off the North Korean forces and sent them up to north of the 38th parallel. But at that time, and a lot of Americans don't know this as well, President Truman and his advisors with MacArthur decided to actually invade North Korea. This is the first time a communist nation had ever been invaded by the U.S. And they did, and they sent troops in there, and they occupied North Korea for a period of months. And then, of course, the Chinese entered the war, pushed the U.S. forces and South Korean forces back down to the 38th parallel, back down to the middle of the country where the division was initially. And that's where the war ended, with the division still there, still very bitter, and with, you know, 3-4 million Koreans dead. And to call that a victory, I think, is just a denial of history, and it's a way to promote the U.S. militarism that helped trigger that war. That war was one of the most destructive in modern history. The United States completely obliterated North Korea in its bombing campaign. Just a terrible, terrible scene after the war and the aftermath. And there's nothing victorious about that for either side. It was a stalemate. That's clearly what it was. And, Korea remains divided today, and there's still an armistice, which means that the actual conditions of war are still there.
Do you think that there's an intention by Obama and others to revitalize the history of that war, as they're investing $65 million in a Vietnam commemoration project to clean up the history of that war, and distorting the recent history of the war in Iraq and others in order to give war as a whole a better image? Or is there some other motivation or an honest mistake here?
Well, I think we have to step back a little bit and look at President Obama's policies in Asia. Listeners may have heard of this so-called Asia tilt, this redirection of U.S. forces toward Asia. Actually, formally, it's called the Asia Pivot, where they're bringing them back, supposedly, from the Middle East and reasserting American forces in Asia. And actually, this is the biggest U.S. military buildup in Asia since the Vietnam War. The U.S. military is trying to cement alliances and build up the Japanese military. It has been pushing them for years to renounce their peace constitution, and now that there's a right-wing government in Japan that's willing to do that, President Obama is very happy with that. And they're also been pushing the South Korean army to link up with their former colonial masters to create a trilateral alliance with the United States between the U.S., Japan, and South Korea. And so the rhetoric of the Korean War, you know, is used to kind of, you know, explain that alliance and say that the United States is, you know, part of a group of countries that are defending the peace, all the kind of language that they usually use for military buildups like this. But it comes at a time of extreme tension in between North and South Korea that's starting to alleviate in the last couple of months. But the U.S. continues to have very large military exercises, conduct large military exercises that are essentially run-throughs of regime change in North Korea, invasions of North Korea, nuclear attacks on North Korea. A few months ago, people may remember that during another large war exercise, President Obama sent B-52 bombers and B-2s and other fighter planes that can always carry nuclear weapons to Korea. And this sent a very strong signal that the U.S. was willing to use even nuclear weapons to, you know, defend its power there and defend its alliance with the South Koreans. And so I think it's a very dangerous situation, and I think they're using this rhetoric of the Korean War to try to persuade Americans that this is the right kind of policy.
When you talk about their rhetoric around keeping the peace, it's interesting that others, including activists you met with over there at the commemoration of the 60th anniversary, talk about there never having yet been a peace, there having been only an armistice. Can you describe what the difference is?
Well, an armistice just means the end of actual physical fighting. And that's, you know, that's what happens at the end of war, of every war, like World War One, there was an armistice. And then the parties are usually required and usually do, in fact, sign a peace agreement and sign a long-term agreements to, you know, have peaceful relations. And that's never happened in Korea. It remains an armistice. And so, you know, technically it really is at a state of war. And so you have this, you know, militarized DMZ, the demilitarized zone. It's just, you know, the biggest. It's the most militarized border in the world by far. And so you have this ongoing tension. And many Koreans in North and South would like eventually to have some kind of reunified peninsula, and particularly to have a reconciled peninsula where the two sides are working together in different ways. And you know, for quite a while, from the late 1990s to from about 1998 until about 2007, there were progressive governments in South Korea that actually reached out and had reached some significant agreements with North Korea on all kinds of things, economic, you know, cultural exchanges, and they built a industrial zone park that is in North Korea where South Korean businesses run it. North Korean workers are employed there, and they produce clothing and electronics and other goods for export. There was a rail line that was built between North and South, and family visits because many of these families in North and South Korea are split and divided, and for a while there was a chance for people to go North and people from North to go South and visit their families. And this all ended in about 2007, 2008. A couple of things happened. There was a very conservative government elected in South Korea and immediately stopped all these kinds of moves toward reconciliation. And also in partly in response, and partly in response to moves that the Bush administration had made, like such as declaring North Korea part of the Axis of Evil. North Korea reacted by building up its missile, rebuilding its missile capacity, or trying to, and also launched a program to build nuclear weapons, and they were successful in building three or four, and they've been testing nuclear weapons, and that, of course, has brought, you know, the crisis, and made it into a crisis where you have calls for denuclearization and the North Koreans resisting it. You know, no talks going on between the U.S. and North Korea, unfortunately.
We're speaking with Tim Shorrock, who writes for The Nation magazine and blogs at timshorrock.com. The foreign forces were supposed to leave after the armistice, if I'm not mistaken, and never have, and the South Korean military remains in some sense under the command of the U.S. military, with a huge U.S. military presence and buildup, and this very controversial proposal for a Navy base on Jeju Island. To what extent is South Korea militarized and under the control and influence of the U.S. military?
Well, first of all, South Korea is the only country in the world that has a military that's commanded by a foreign general at times of war. There's a joint command between the U.S. and South Korean militaries that's unique in the world. It used to be that the U.S. commander was in charge all the time, and a few years ago they allowed the South Korean commander to be in charge during peacetime. But in war, a U.S. general would run both armies, would command both armies. And this is a situation that a lot of South Koreans are very uncomfortable with and are, in fact, trying to address, because they believe that South Korea really cannot be a sovereign country until a foreign general ends command of its military during times of war. So that's one issue. But yes, at the end of the war, you know, foreign troops were supposed to be withdrawn. The U.S. troops never were, and there were, in fact, Chinese troops that quickly withdrew from North Korea at the end of the war. And when you go to the DMZ now, you know, from either side, the only foreign soldiers you will ever see are American. And, you know, that's pretty clear to Koreans. And you see these Americans all over that border area. I was up there at the end of July. And, of course, you know, that's the only foreign soldiers you see. And so this is a relationship that's you know, fraught with danger for South Koreans, because the U.S. military likes to integrate the South Korean military into its broader plans for the region. And so South Korea kind of becomes subservient to U.S. military aims in the Northeast Asia region. And in fact, you know, troops, the U.S. troops in Korea are, they often take part in, have gone to the Middle East and are used to project U.S. forces. Those bases are used to project U.S. forces not only in Asia, but all around the world. And so South Korea, in fact, is part of the U.S. military structure. And there's been talk about, you know, changing that command. And it, in fact, it will go under Korean command in a few years, but it keeps getting delayed. And the U.S. side keeps coming up with reasons to delay it. And so that remains a very big issue. But I think overall, an issue in South Korea is, you know, this confrontation with North Korea. Even at the, you know, worst crises between U.S. and Pyongyang over the last couple of years, people in South Korea are not that concerned about a war with North Korea. It's usually the Americans are, and they see it as primarily a dispute between North Korea and the United States that they would like to see resolved. And they would like to see a peace agreement. They would like to see this war, state of war, brought to an end with a peace agreement, with a formal peace treaty that would end the Korean War and allow both sides to, you know, to move on. And so I think that's really the critical issue. And the more the U.S. and South Korea do these war games that are practicing, you know, run-throughs of overthrowing the North Korean government, the more paranoid the North Korean government gets, and the farther you move away from that possibility. So I think there's a long way to go before that can happen, but it's certainly, moves toward peace would be would be very good for the whole region.
When we hear about something that sounds like it makes obvious sense, we always have to wonder what are the influences pushing it the other way. And you note in The Nation magazine and on your website that South Korea is a very big customer for U.S. weapons, which is a very profitable industry. And at the same time that we're seeing this militarization, we of course are also seeing a push for so-called free trade agreements, including one between Korea and the United States. How are these influences impacting the situation?
Of course, yeah, weapon sales are major. I mean, the U.S. supplies South Korea with all kinds of weapons, from F-16s to armored personnel carriers, all kinds of ammunition, etc. And South Korea is one of the largest buyers of U.S. weapons in the world, up in the top five. And so that's a major factor. Right now, there's a big competition going on for new fighter jets, and of course, Boeing and Lockheed Martin are pushing very hard to sell their wares there. And South Korea itself has a large military establishment. And so, just like here, the military industrial complex exists there. And, those forces, the greater the confrontation, the greater the tension, the more they can sell weapons. And so the moves toward peace are not really, pushed by that sector and move in the opposite direction, in fact. So that's clearly a very big factor and something that many South Koreans would like to see changed.
And what do they think about the...
As far as the trade agreement goes, I mean, the free trade agreement with South Korea went through last year, and it was was approved and is actually in the process of being implemented. And it's the same kind of agreement that we've seen with other countries that are basically to benefit the flow of capital and not to benefit anybody else. I mean, it's the same kind of contradiction between the free movement of capital, but what workers can do and the power of workers and the power of consumers to question policies being implemented by business and foreign business are very much curtailed by these kinds of treaties. And so there was a lot of opposition to it in South Korea, as there was here.
When you were there in South Korea for the 60th anniversary of the armistice, I take it you met what you spoke on a panel and at a rally and met with activists, including Japanese activists taking part in peace activism in Korea. There was, I take it, great popular opposition to current policies.
Yes, there is. And actually, I was invited by a political party that was an amalgamation of three political parties in the South Korean National Assembly. One of them was a labor party, and the other were two sort of left-wing parties that were formed and organized by longtime democratic, environmental, and feminist activists, actually. And these parties merged and became one party, United Progressive Party, and they have a few seats in the National Assembly. In fact, the president of the party actually ran in the last presidential election last December against the current President Park, and she debated her in the presidential debates. She actually withdrew right before the end of the presidential election, so the liberal candidate might have a better chance of beating President Park, who was the very conservative candidate. But there's South Korea went through a lot during the 1970s and 80s in the movement for democracy. People remember Kim Dae-jung, the great democratic leader who was eventually elected president of South Korea, was part of this movement, and there was a massive movement to democratize the country and get rid of the military authoritarian rule. And that military government finally was toppled in the 1980s with just massive demonstrations in the streets for weeks and weeks. 1987, and they finally the military finally capitulated and allowed open elections to take place. And so there's been a long process, and out of that there's been an incredible amount of organizing, unions, so organized independent labor unions starting in the 70s and 80s and became a very powerful force. So there's a very long history of democratic and labor activism in South Korea, and I can testify from my own personal experience being there the last time was just how incredibly organized they are, and the ability to bring out massive numbers of people for demonstrations is pretty awesome to see. During my visit, there was two demonstrations that I attended. Actually, three. One of them was a demonstration for a peace treaty. It was in front of the U.S. military garrison in downtown Seoul at this base called Yongsan. There were, several thousand people there. And then later that evening, there was another demonstration in the downtown plaza in Seoul, which was also for the peace treaty. And then also that morphed into a demonstration against the National Intelligence Service's intervention in domestic politics. There's been a major scandal there of the intelligence service, which used to be known as the KCIA and was very dreaded by anybody doing activism there. And it was basically, it was weakened during the period of democracy, but the last few years of conservative rule, the intelligence services have become very powerful again. And they've been using social media and all kinds of ways to basically weaken the democratic forces. And the scandal now is over their possible intervention in the last presidential election, where they use social networks to attack opposition candidates. They made up names, and it was all a secret campaign that just recently came out that it was being actually led by national intelligence agents. And so this has created a demand for investigations and a look at the power of the intelligence services there. But the power to organize and get people out in the streets is very very impressive there.
I think the NSA has been exposed, among many, many other things, as spying on South Korea. Is there any indication of U.S. involvement in the scandal you're talking about?
Not in the scandal I'm talking about, but actually, the U.S. and South Korean intelligence have had very close relationships over long periods of time. And, when there's surveillance and intelligence on North Korea, of course, almost all that comes from the United States. There's a large base now in a place called Pyeongtaek near Seoul, just south of Seoul, where all the U.S. military is going to be consolidated in a few years. And that actually is a huge intelligence base, a huge NSA listening post. And, of course, there's U-2s based in South Korea that fly over the peninsula and the waters near North Korea and pick up all kinds of communications. But, when you're outside the United States, you can listen, and the NSA listens in on whoever they want to listen in, whether it's North or South Korea. So there is a massive amount of intelligence, those signals intelligence and all kinds of telephone, internet that we've seen in the last couple weeks being revealed by The Guardian that the NSA is doing there in Korea. And many Koreans, generally assume that whatever they say and communicate can be picked up by intelligence services by the U.S. and passed on to their South Korean counterparts. So there's a lot of attention on that. And I think that in many ways, the focus on intelligence is similar to here. These people think that the intelligence services are out of control and have way too much power, and need to be curtailed. And there needs to be much more oversight over what they do, just like here.
Maybe we can work together on it. I know that U.S. peace activists who've been over to Jeju Island have been incredibly impressed by the activism and resistance to the construction of the base there. It sounds like U.S. activists increasingly concerned about the so-called intelligence agencies and the South Koreans have some things in common there. To what extent is there potential for working together against U.S. militarism in South Korea and elsewhere?
Well, I think there's very strong potential. Jeju Island is a case in point. Yes, they've had an incredible struggle there against building a Navy base. The South Korean is trying to build a Navy base there. It's a beautiful island. has a very long history. In fact, in 1946, there was a massive uprising there against the U.S.-supported government, in which hundreds of thousands of people were actually killed in that. And there's been there's large memorials in that island to that to that revolt and what happened. And so they're resisting this naval base because they just say it's going to further militarize the peninsula, and they know that U.S. forces are going to use the naval base as well. It's right across the waters from Shanghai in China, so they just see it as part of the new sort of U.S. confrontation, military confrontation with China as well. And I think there's real common ground there between, you know, U.S. and South Korean activists. But I have to say that on the issue of trade and the issue of the free trade, free trade agreement, I think some of the U.S. left took a very backward position by making a very big issue out of this industrial zone that was in the north and saying that there should not be any goods that came out of that industrial zone should not be part of any goods that are exported by South Korea. And I think what these activists didn't understand is that that industrial zone is seen by people in North and South Korea as the most important symbol of their attempts to have reconciliation and unification, and that without some economic assistance and an actual investment from South Korea, North Korean economy is going to continue to, you know, go downhill and not be able to develop the kind of technology it needs to have a, you know, decent productive economy for its people. So that's seen as a very important step, and I think by just making this blanket assertion that this industrial zone was somehow a threat to U.S. national security because it would give North Korea the currency to build weapons is a real backward way of looking at it, and essentially denies South Korea's and North Korea's sovereignty and integrity as independent countries. And I think we need to respect the, you know, what Koreans want to do with their own country and try to bridge that gap. That's a very important, you know, gap to be discussed because I think it created a lot of distrust on the South Korean side because, you know, from the conservative ruling party there to the most militant labor unions, they all support this industrial zone. And to have Americans come in and say, you know, you shouldn't do this because it's going to hurt our interest seemed very arrogant. And I think there's an arrogance that goes along with the American relationship with Korea that we as activists interested in peace need to look at very, very carefully and go look at our assumptions about Korea. North Korea is, you know, often just portrayed as a bunch of crazy people who loosely decide to threaten the United States with nuclear weapons. And nobody really looks at the history of the U.S. Threats of using nuclear weapons against North Korea, the massive bombing the U.S. did in North Korea, the terrible destruction wrought by U.S. firepower in that war is just, you know, when you read the histories, I suggest people read Bruce Cumings' history of the Korean War, you get a sense of how terrible it was. And I think there's a lot of information that we need about Korea to really understand the situation, but I think we really should work together with the democratic movement there to try to move toward peace and try to cut back and eventually have the U.S. troops removed from South Korea. 60 years is a long time to have American forces in another country.
It is indeed. I would recommend also that people listen to Bruce Cumings in a new film called Ghosts of Jeju, made by an activist from the United States who went over to Jeju Island. In the minute or so that we have left, Tim Shorrock, what can ordinary people, particularly in the United States, do to try to move toward a peace treaty and an end, final end to the Korean War?
Well, I would say, you know, put some pressure on your representatives and urge them to back calls for an end to the tensions and urge the United States to talk directly with the North Korean government. I think without some kind of negotiation, this will never be resolved. And I think instead of just, you know, using military force and military threats, it would be much more useful to have direct discussions and try to do all we can to support the desire of South and North Koreans to have reconciliation and eventual unification. I think that Americans have a lot to learn on that. And, you know, just don't believe all what you read in the mainstream press, which is sort of general advice, but the mainstream press coverage of Korea is pretty terrible.
Very well said. We've been speaking with Tim Shorrock, who writes for The Nation magazine, blogs at timshorrock.com, and I'll have the links up on the website of Talk Nation Radio. Tim, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.